Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest today is Gabriella Burnham, author of It Is Wood, It Is Stone, a gorgeous debut novel set in Brazil. First things first, this novel is told in second person by Linda, an American woman whose privileged history professor husband takes an offer to teach in Sao Paulo for a year. She's a former reporter, a writer, artistic, feeling disenfranchised, struggling in her marriage. Before the trip, Linda was contemplating leaving her husband. But this place at this time foments an awakening, artistic and otherwise, and there are several catalysts for this. One is meeting Marta, the maid who serves the faculty apartment they move into, as she has for many years through many personnel changes. Marta cooks, she cleans, she speaks English, and she might have a bead on Linda, who grapples with what it means to have a maid and how to act around Marta. Their relationship brings up issues of race and class and social standing and autonomy. And their fragile domestic détente is challenged when Linda meets an intriguing woman at a bar who offers to show her around town and becomes an increasingly large part of her life. Kirkus calls the novel, quote, a transporting debut that deftly probes the complex nature of relationships between women, end quote. Gabriella Burnham holds dual citizenship in the United States and Brazil. She earned an MFA in creative writing from the Writers Foundry at St. Joseph's College and fellowships to McDowell Colony and Yaddo. She has worked as a reporter, a creative writing teacher, and in immigration law. She'll join us from her home in New York soon. But first, a word from one of our sponsors for this episode, Amazon Original Stories, about their thrilling Hush collection. What is the truth? How do you trust what you think you know? In stories featuring conspirators, psychics, deceptive lovers, and desperate killers, some of today's most popular crime writers, including Ruth Ware, Oyinkan Breathwaite, and Lisa Unger, explore the very nature of truth and the risks in uncovering the lies. Read the Hush collection from Amazon Original Stories. Visit amazon.com/hush. And now, let's talk with Gabriella Burnham, author of It Is Wood, It Is Stone. Welcome, Gabby, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Megan.
So you just found out some really exciting news about this novel, like just now.
Yeah, I just found out that it's an Amazon Best Book of the Month for August, which is so exciting.
That's wild. And it came out 1 week ago. Right?
Yeah, it just came out Tuesday, the 28th.
Oh my God. What has this week been like for you?
It's been wild for so many different reasons.
Right.
I mean, you know, the time that we're in now, I haven't really left my apartment to celebrate. All of the celebration has been happening virtually, which we're all very used to. But
right.
Because of that, like the day that it happened, I woke up and I expected something, you know, like some sort of shift in the air. And we were just still in the apartment. But then when I opened up Instagram and kind of went into the virtual space again, that's where all the celebration was happening. And it really, that started to make it feel real. Like, wow, it's, even though I'm still in this apartment, my book is out there reaching people somehow. So yeah, it's walking around while I can't. been really incredible. And getting messages from people who I grew up with and I haven't seen in decades, and them telling me how much the book moved them and how proud they are of me and how proud they are that someone from their hometown published a book. I mean, that's probably been the most special thing for me.
And which hometown is this?
I'm from Nantucket, mm-hmm. which is a small island off of the coast of Cape Cod. It's a very mm-hmm. popular vacation spot. that's how most people know it, but I'm part of the, you know, year-round local community, which is a very different community than the people who summer there.
Oh, I'm absolutely sure. I read in your bio that you have dual citizenship with Brazil and the United States.
Yes. So my mom's from Brazil and my entire extended family still lives in Brazil and are, you know, very much born and raised in Brazil. So it's another very special place to me.
And this very special debut novel is very much set in Brazil. I'd say a vast majority of the action takes place there. To get into it, I mean, the first question that appears in this book, first page, second paragraph, it's in dialogue. It's, is it what you expected? Mm. If I were to answer that as a reader of your book, I would be like, absolutely not. You blew my mind. But I want to ask you, you know, in this question, who's asking, who answers, where are they, and how did this situation come to be?
Yeah, so the novel is told from the first person perspective of Linda, and she's telling the story to her husband, Dennis, in retrospect. So the whole book is written to you, Dennis, as a kind of reclaiming of this moment in her life. When the book opens, Linda is in this state of crisis, really, in her life. She realizes that nothing she has is really hers. All of the money that she has is from her husband. All of their friends are his friends from the university where he teaches. And she's just lost her father, and she spent the last year caring for him, and now has all this furniture she's inherited from him, and it's all over their home. And she wants to separate from Dennis and go maybe live in Italy or somewhere to escape for a bit. But instead, Dennis tells her that he has been offered a teaching opportunity in São Paulo. And so she says, well, maybe I can escape there with him and I won't have to actually leave him behind. And so the book opens when they're arriving in São Paulo. And I think the answer is no, it's not what she expected. She expected to arrive and be able to change and to feel like a completely different person. And what ends up happening is she's not only having to grapple with her own internal struggles with depression, anxiety, with feeling like she doesn't have agency in her own life, but then also the fact that she is a white American woman who has been plopped in this fancy neighborhood in São Paulo, and she's now the wife of this esteemed professor who's been invited to teach there, and all of these the social status that she's been put in feels very contradictory with how she's feeling inside. And so she's having to grapple with that as well.
Right. And, you know, one of the biggest, she's so internalized at the beginning, I'd say. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, she does have depression. This manifests itself in many ways, including a kind of, you know, subconscious self-harming. You know, in dreams, she tends to dig her nails into her palms until she bloodies them. Mm-hmm. You know, so she's grappling with a lot in her life at this time. And like the first conceptually, like the first thing she is trying to grapple with or surmount or understand, or, you know, it's almost a capoeira of ideas, yeah, with this idea of having a maid mm-hmm. in this new apartment as the professor's wife. She is a white woman with a black maid in Brazil, and she like cannot even, you know, it's like cognitive dissonance.
Yes, exactly. And she thinks that when she meets Marta, she thinks, let's just ignore this very obvious class and racial difference between us, and let's just pretend like we're best friends. And so she thinks that she can help Marta with cooking, with cleaning, and that they're just going to be equals immediately. And Marta doesn't allow that to happen. She kind of ignores Linda. And so I was very interested in exploring, you know, there's an obvious power dynamic between them in that Linda is the boss and yeah. Marta is her maid. But in a lot of ways, Marta actually is the one who wields power over Linda, because Linda is so desperate for Marta's affection and to feel like they are equals, so that in some ways she doesn't have to grapple with the fact that they're not. So it was really, as a writer, really fun for me to explore the way that their power is constantly shifting between the two of them.
Yeah, because when we see like her thought process too, it's even, you know, at one point, like kind of moves beyond equality to like almost a sort of subordination, as if she would learn from Marta, you know, how to cook Brazilian dishes or how to keep the house in this way. You know, it's a really interesting power interplay. Mm-hmm. And early in the book, you know, in some of the earliest chapters, as we're being told this story by Linda, she's like, most of the chapters start with the variations of like, the first time I met Marta, or the night after I met Marta. And like this narrative, this early narrative is being defined against Marta and like the time she marks.
Yeah, so, you know, Linda is, as you said, she's so internalized in the beginning. And part of her evolution as a person, as a character, is her experiencing a relational world, a collective experience, not one that is so individualized. That's Linda's trap in the beginning. And that is what, you know, I think that's what depression does to people, but I think it's also what late capitalism does to people, that you become so kind of individualized and forget how to kind of relate your experience with other experiences and then relate other experiences back into your experience. And so that's what's going on with Linda in the beginning. She's every interaction she has with her husband and with Marta early on are in contrast and in contradiction to what she's doing. And she needs to kind of learn how to integrate and open up. And the writing shifts too by the end, that it's not so focused on every little detail and not so obsessive. It becomes more kind of open, you know, to the world around her.
Who is your favorite character to write in this book?
Oh, man. So Marta is my favorite character, but she was the most difficult character for me to write, which might be my favorite character then. sometimes the most difficult characters can be turned into your favorite character, because when you feel like you got it and you nailed it, then it's such a great feeling. You know, Linda could be a very exhausting character to write at times. When I was so in her head, it would, you know, some days I was just like, I feel like I need to just shift out and write in the third person or write something else. Cause she has such an intense way of looking at things at times. But Marta's character is the character that is closest to Brazil. Her backstory was one of the last pieces that I wrote for the book. And she's from the town where my mother grew up, at Tibaia. Mm. And her experience is much closer to my family's experience in Brazil. And I love her for that reason. But it was a very difficult thing for me to write, because it meant I would have to write about Brazil in a much closer way than through Linda's experience. And that was hard for me. I mean, I grew up in the United States. I don't speak Portuguese fluently, but all of my family is in Brazil, and a lot of them don't speak English. Mm. And so I struggled a lot with feeling like I could actually write about Brazil, or whether I could even call myself Brazilian American, because I was still figuring out what my connection to Brazil was. Mm. And so writing Marta's character was so difficult for me. But then once I did do it, it really felt like, it felt so liberating. And yeah. I now have this document, you know, this symbol of my connection to Brazil in written form. And that meant so much to me to be able to do that.
Yeah. What was research like to, you know, undergird this writing?
Oh, you know, it's. I've been thinking about that a lot, research for fiction, because especially for a debut, I think that everything turns into research. You know, it's like my entire life leading up to me writing this book is research in some way. You know, you start for a debut, I was like, oh, I want to pull every interesting thing I've ever thought of into this book. And then it was like a whittling away of that. You know, I think that for Marta's story specifically, I did some research and just understanding from that specific time period, Brazil was under military dictatorship at that time. And so I wanted to research specifically what that meant for the community that she's from in Atibaia and the ways in which those rural communities were defunded in terms of schooling and health services, and any kind of public services were rooted out of rural communities and put into urbanization. And so, you know, the details of Marta's school being a space that's used for school and church and multiple different services for the community, and that it's run down, and the experience of Marta not being able to go to high school, and that they had to choose one, and her brother was the one who continued education in high school. This was all based off of research, and also my actual family's experience. So there was that, and then, you know, I think just researching and making sure things like streets and all of the things that when you're really from a community, you know, like the back of your hand. But because yeah. I'm not born and raised in Brazil, you know, that kind of research went into it too.
Marta is a character who will, you know, stick with me for a really long time. There's so many ways we come to know all of the characters in this book, and there's one flash of inspiration, insight provided by when Linda penetrates Marta's, you know, own space within their apartment. There are two books there. One is a paperback Bible, and one is 100 Years of Solitude. Curiously and delightfully, that's not the only instance of a character being identified by just two books in their possession. So I wanted to just pull out of the book right now and ask you, if you were writing yourself as a character, what are two books that we might know you by?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm just going to answer based off of the first thing that comes to mind, which is Near to the Wild Heart by Clarice Lispector.
Ooh.
And The Days of Abandonment by Elena Ferrante. Those two books were two books I read after I started writing my novel. And when I first started writing It Is What It Is Stone, if you can imagine, it was way more experimental, way more internalized. And when I read Near to the Wild Heart, I had this feeling, I put the book down and I started crying. And I was like, wow, I am reading a writer. I mean, not only is she Brazilian, and there are some unusual kind of biographic connections that I have with Clarice Lispector, but I really felt like, wow, this is a writer who I feel like so connected to on a visceral level, at the core of us. Yeah. I was in disbelief. And in some ways I was like, she's already done everything that I want to do as a writer. Like, what should I even really continue? Cause she nailed it. So yeah. And then I'm such a fan, as so many people are, of Elena Ferrante. And of course her series, and Neapolitan series is incredible. But I think The Days of Abandonment, I just love the way that her character, you know, just to take a step back, I just read a review on Amazon of my book. And the only reason I saw this is because of the book of the month thing, but someone titled their review, "Not Much Happens, But I Couldn't Put It Down." And I was like, yes, you get it. Exactly. And The Days of Abandonment was like that. Like, not much happens. It's about a woman who is getting divorced, and she finds out, it's a huge shock to her, and she finds out that her husband is already in a relationship with someone else, and she slowly starts to go insane in her home, and things like taking care of her children and taking care of the her dog just seem like impossible tasks. Even turning the door handle at one point is just like, how do I do this? And I just thought it was incredible. So incredible. And so I would say those two books.
Wow.
Yeah.
not much happens, but I couldn't put it down. Oh, my God. And among other things, I think that response marks the first time in the course of the body of this podcast that the title of this novel was mentioned. It is wood. It is stone. Could you speak a little bit about the provenance of the title?
Sure. So It Is Wood, It Is Stone is a translation of the first two lines of this bossa nova jazz song called Aguas de Março. And the version of that song that I listened to over and over again while writing this book is by Elise Regina, who is a singer, a Brazilian singer who's kind of like a national treasure in Brazil. And she died when she was really young, but she's very politically active at a time in Brazil when there was mass censorship of the arts, and it was very dangerous for people to be outspoken about their political beliefs. So, which is also true right now in Brazil. So I just love that song. I love her. Tom Jobim is the original writer, but the lyrics are just this kind of a medley of images, objects, feelings, moments that are all washing together in the waters of March, which is the end of summer in Brazil. And it's sort of a meditation on the way that while we think of life as this linear experience, really it's this collision of all of our experiences and our ancestors' experiences and our history coming together at once so that we can be reborn again. And that, I think, is at the core of Linda's experience. I think of Marta's experience too, in some ways Celia's experience. That was the seed where I started in writing this book. And yeah, images of wood and stone repeat themselves through the book, which only a couple people have picked up on. I, as like an English literature student, was like, everyone is going to notice this and and write, you know, papers about the symbolism, and no one has talked about it.
they may yet. It's only been 1 week.
The symbols of wood and stone kind of become these symbols, I think, from my interpretation of the ways in which we are able to transform and transition and the ways in which we become grounded in what we've done or who we are or the way we think of the world. But I cannot wait to see those English literature papers come out to hear other your other interpretation.
I'll have you know that I, English literature major, did observe the thinginess of the imagery on page 12. When Marta emerged, she was wearing a purple apron with ladybugs embroidered along the hem. She used this apron like a toolkit. Inside was a bamboo toothbrush, a small Swiss army knife, a cloth handkerchief, and a fan that she unfurled when she was hot, revealing a lily garden and a koi fish pond. Right there in the marginalia, things. And that is, it is like when we are being first drawn into, I mean, like Linda wakes up for the first time in Brazil and there's that moment of where am I in space? You know, like, where is my body? How did I get here? This is unfamiliar. This is new. And like taking kind of an inventory of what's around you allows you to kind of come back down to earth.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm still working on my paper.
That's no pressure.
That's the first thought. I do want to ask you something else. Way back at the beginning of our conversation, you kind of the way you put it, I loved something along the lines of like, Linda, it tells this story in first person. Like it is issuing from her and it's her perspective, but she tells it to Dennis. And when, you know, I'm sure when this manuscript circulated, people were like, oh, second person, whoa, because kind of in the industry, like, there's just, you know, I've heard tons of times, like, it's hard to do that well, you know? Like, a lot of people seem to think that, like, second person is sort of radioactive. Like, what was your experience when people encountered this book?
Well, even further back than that, I started writing this when I was in an MFA program, and the reason I didn't when I wrote the first kind of sketch of an image of what this would eventually turn into, I didn't know I was writing a book. But the reason why I wrote that was because my professor at the time warned us against second person and said that, you know, readers tend to have a terrible reaction to it. And so, of course, the first thing I did was write something in the second person to try to unwind that stereotype. But yeah, it was, I will say, I think that I love my agent and my editor so much because they were both like, we could not see this book written a different way. And I really felt that. I mean, I won't lie, there were times when I, as I was writing it, I was like, should I try to just do this in a straightforward first person, because it's so difficult to write in the second person, especially when Dennis wasn't there, like part of the experience at all, to try to figure out a way to bring him back into moments. I don't know how much we can kind of give away in terms of plot details, but there's one moment that is extremely intimate between her and another character, and trying to come up with a way, I knew it was so important for her to introduce her husband back into that moment, because she is telling it to him, but figuring out a way to do that while maintaining the intimacy between those two characters was so difficult. So there were times where I was like, maybe I shouldn't do this. Maybe I should make it easier for myself. But I actually couldn't. It was the only way that Linda would tell the story. The you kept coming back in. So I knew there was no other way I could write it. But when I tried to sell the book, I did, there was one very notable rejection from a big publisher that we were really excited about, and they rejected it. I mean, this is coming from my agent, but because of second person, that it just wasn't going to work for them. So, you know, it's always difficult to hear when the core of something that you've written seems to be something that isn't going to sell. But, you know, I believed in it enough to keep it. And I'm so glad I did, because I think it's the way that Linda wanted to tell her story.
I'm thrilled to hear that. And I'm thrilled that it went to the editor it went to. What I'm imagining that the relationship working with all of the staff at One World is exciting and wonderful.
If we could just have an entire segment so I could talk about how wonderful the One World team is. I mean, it's hard to overstate how personal it is writing a book.
Yeah.
It is, especially a book where, you know, I am white, I'm exploring race dynamics, I think in a way that I haven't seen in literature, mostly because a lot of white writers don't write about race, notably absent from their books, and they're not expected to, you know, but then also class dynamics and also just the style of the writing is challenging. And all because of all of that, it's so personal and it feels like so much is at stake. And to be with a team like the One World team, and especially my editor, Nicole Counts, I mean, we had so many difficult conversations where even outside of the book, we were having to talk about how to explore racial dynamics. And she's Black. And so it was us actually just talking to each other about our experience of race in the world. And it was, I'm so glad that she took the time to do that with me, because she really believed in my writing and my ability to think through these things. I honestly can't thank her enough for that. And we're now just really close as people too. And it's a beautiful thing. I love it.
It is a beautiful thing. It is a beautiful thing to talk and to listen, to be heard. You, in your background, you have experience as a reporter?
Oh, yes. Well, this was when I was in college back on Nantucket. I wrote for the local newspaper there. Yeah.
Oh my God, we could do a whole podcast on. I used to write for the local newspaper where I'm from. Oh yeah, yeah. All the skills you see here are from local news and other.
I have to tell you, I mean, because I was young and also a young woman, I often was assigned mostly fluff feature pieces.
Right.
But I will tell you, because I'm from Nantucket, and I was reporting in the summertime, that often meant interviewing you know, famous people. I would interview, you know, for the film festival there, actors who came on. And then I also pitched a couple stories that were picked up for the Cape Cod Times. And so it was, you know, it was actually a really incredible and informative experience because it forces you to write on a deadline every week. And just push writing out. And also it was, you know, when I first started working there, I was 19 years old and having to just make cold calls to people. I was so nervous to do it in the press room that I would go into my car and do my interviews from the car, but it forced me to just do it and to do it under a deadline. And so because of that, I you know, don't really experience writer's block anymore because I just know how to kind of get the words out. So it was, yeah, it was a great experience because of that.
Yeah. And it puts so many different voices in your head, you know, the dialogue in this book is super strong. And I think it reflects a good listener.
Thank you.
Yeah. But I mean, enough compliments from me. We were talking before we actually got on the tape and you were saying what the highest compliment a reader of this book could pay you was. Would you kindly let our listeners know what that would be?
Yeah, so I've been getting messages mostly from people who I grew up with saying that they have that kind of empty, sad feeling at the end of the book, like they know that a story that they love is over. And, you know, in writing this book, I wanted to write a book that I would love to read. And that to me is a mark of a book that I love, that when you get to the last page, it's you want to get to the last page because you want to know what happens. But then ending the book means that you can't ever have that experience of opening it for the first time again and being in the middle of it. And so the fact that people are picking up on that with this book is that makes the entire publishing experience worth it to me. It's so, so incredibly special to hear.
I can think of no better place for us to end this conversation. Gabby, thank you so much for your generosity. Thank you for joining me today on Fully Booked.
Thank you so much, Megan. It was really a pleasure.
That was Gabriella Burnham, author of It Is Wood, It Is Stone, debut novel out now from One World. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks and books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks and books for the week. We have Young Readers editors Vicki Smith and Laura Simeon, and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau is out of office today. Starting with Vicki, what's your choice this week?
My choice is a new book by Kimberly Brubaker Bradley, who, full disclosure, is also a reviewer for the children's and teen sections. And she has a new book. It's called Fighting Words, and it's about this absolutely unforgettable character named Della, whose mother has been in prison for years for meth. And so Della and her older sister Suki has been in the care, isn't really putting it the right way, but sort of they've been living in the house of their mother's boyfriend, who is just a monster. And over the course of the book, you really learn how much of a monster he is. But when the book starts, Della and Suki have been taken away from the boyfriend after a conflagration that we don't know quite what happened. And Della has to go to school and she is not loving it. Della has a way with words, as you may guess from the title. For the sensibilities of her readers, she's decided to render every single swear word as snow. Pretty early on in the book, her teacher assigns a family tree project, and Della doesn't want to do the family tree project. I mean, a family tree project is an especially cruel project to give, because there's so many kids who've got, you know, things going on in their family trees that may be difficult for them to understand, or they just don't want to lay it all out in front of a teacher. And so Della says, the assignment is snow. I got in trouble for saying snow. I knew I would. That's why I said it. I got to take a little trip down to the principal's office. The principal and I are practically friends by now. Her name is Dr. Penny. Penny is her last name, I asked. Dr. Penny said, Della, to what do I owe the pleasure of seeing you this time? I said, I'm not doing that assignment. I can't fix my family tree and it's nobody's business but mine. Oh, said Dr. Penny. Then she asked what I was doing instead of the assignment, and then she agreed that drawing a wolf seemed like a reasonable compromise. She said she'd have a word with Ms. Devante. I said, Louisa doesn't want to draw her family tree either, or Nevaeh. Nevaeh's dad left a few years ago. Louisa, I didn't know her whole story, but I saw the way her eyes emptied out when Ms. Devante told us what she wanted us to do. Ms. Devante is still not listening until she has to. Dr. Penny sighed. I don't know who she was sighing at, she said. I'll talk to her, Della. I said, she ought to be paying better attention. I'm only 10 years old, and I noticed Louise's eyes and the ways Nevaeh's shoulders tightened. Ms. Devante is the teacher. Dr. Penny said, it might be helpful, Della, if you quit using words like snow. I said, probably not. I wasn't trying to give her lip. I said, when I said snow, I got to come down here and explain this to you. If I didn't say snow, I'd have to say why I don't want to draw a family tree. The whole class would have heard my business, and then I'd get made fun of on the playground. Dr. Penny paused. She looked at me for what felt like a long time. Then she said, thank you for that explanation. She suggested I sit in the comfy chair in her office until recess. She had a shelf of books I could read. I don't like books much, but there was one about dinosaur poop that was interesting. So that's Della, and that's Fighting Words. And this book tackles so many tough things, but Della is such an incredible character, and she's so smart and so perceptive that she carries readers right on through it.
I'm kind of mesmerized. Vicki, could you just keep reading that?
I would love to read this book from cover to cover. It's so good.
God, it sounds really great. It made me think of this book that I really love, which is not, I wouldn't call it a read-alike because it's not at all for kids. I would not recommend it for kids, but it's called Where the Dead Sit Talking by Brandon Hobson, which was a finalist for the National Book Award a few years ago in adult fiction. And it's about a boy named Sequoia, who's a 15-year-old Cherokee boy, and he's in foster care in a family that also had already had two other foster children. And they're very kind of welcoming and permissive, and you know, all the kids kind of do their own thing in a way, which is good, but it's bad. And the book is just beautifully written and sad and complicated and interesting, and it just made me think that if you're an adult and you're looking for a book with smart kids that sounds similar to Della, this is a good one.
I will put it on my list, my very, very long list, Lori. Thank you.
For your list, Vicki's pick this week is called Fighting Words, and it's by Kimberly Brubaker Bradley. Thank you, Vicki, for that pick. Turning now to Laura. Laura, what's your choice for us?
This week I have a graphic novel called The Daughters of Ys. It's by M.T. Anderson and illustrated by Joe Ryu. And this is one for teens and adults. I would not give it to younger kids. It's inspired by an ancient folktale for me that's sort of reminiscent of Atlantis. It's about this city that was swallowed by the ocean. And, you know, it's a legend from France. And, you know, like a lot of folktales, it can be intense and bloody and has some kind of, you know, mature themes, but I will say it's probably not worse than a lot of the video games and things that kids watch normally. So, and it's handled very well. But so basically there's Queen Mogven and King Gradlon, and they have two daughters. There's Rosen, who loves sort of cavorting in nature. And she's got this wonderful horse, who's black with a silver mane, who's just the illustrations. I wish I could show you the pictures. They're just so beautiful. And she meets this handsome young man while she's out, you know, listening to birds and everything. And then there's her sister, Dahut, who's quite different. Dahut harnesses magic to kill suitors and feed them to sea monsters who keep the city safe. But at some point, it all just goes wrong and Ys is consumed by the sea. And it's very dramatic. And it's done in these kind of jewel tones. And it invokes that kind of Celtic style, like the culture of the region. And the prose also, it's very accessible. So it's not, you know, sometimes there can be this kind of anachronistic feeling when things are, well, I wouldn't say it's modernized, but in the speech of older folktales that are retold. But it's seamless. It's done so well. It's really riveting. And again, visually stunning. I want to get prints from this book to hang on my walls.
M.T. Anderson is one of the most consistently surprising people writing for kids these days. And I guess consistently and surprising are kind of weird when you put them together. But his range is amazing. And, you know, he's done picture books and dystopian fiction. I think Feed is, you know, a book people, everybody still should read. And the great historical books about the Revolutionary War and Black soldiers within it. I mean, I think that one of the other things about M.T. Anderson is that, like this book, a lot of really cross over well to adult audiences. Yeah. And there's one that I love a lot that I think everybody should read, and it's Symphony for the City of the Dead. And it's about the symphony that Shostakovich wrote during the Siege of Leningrad and that was played by the musicians of the Leningrad Symphony Orchestra. And they were all practically dead when they played it, but it rallied the city as the siege ground on. And that may not sound like a pleasant read, but it's absolutely riveting. And it's a book that you don't have to know a whole lot about Russian history or music to appreciate. But if you do know about either of both of those things, you will appreciate it a whole ton. So yeah, M.T. Anderson has always got something new. Goodness knows what he'll do next.
Laura's pick for the week is The Daughters of Ys by M.T. Anderson and Joe Ryu. Thank you, Laura, for that choice. And finally, we've got Fiction with Lori. Lori, what have you chosen for us?
I have a fantastic first novel called Luster by Raven Leilani, which, as you know, I interviewed her for our August 1st issue, and she's just super smart and interesting in talking about what she was trying to do in the novel. So let me recommend, first of all, that you go look on our website and see what she has to say. The book is about a woman named Edie who's in her early 20s, she's an art school dropout who is working in a job in publishing, in children's book publishing. And as the book opens, she's having online sex with a guy named Eric, who she met in some, you know, dating app of some kind, and who she's never met in person. But he's told her that he is married, but he has an open marriage. Which, you know, when you see that, you immediately think, yeah, right. But, you know, it's true. He actually does have an open marriage, because a bit into the book, when Edie hasn't heard from him for a while, she just kind of gets on a train and goes out to his house in New Jersey, and the door is open and she just walks in and starts poking around. She doesn't see anybody there. Nobody seems to be home. And she like goes into his bedroom and starts poking through the closet. And then his wife walks in and she clearly immediately knows who Edie is, and just invites her to stay for dinner. And then it turns out that it's their anniversary party. Rebecca, who's the wife, and Eric, it's their anniversary party. And Rebecca has invited Edie to stay for this. And the whole scene is sort of very weird. Oh, the thing that I forgot to mention is that Edie is Black and Rebecca and Eric are white. And they have an adopted daughter, Akilah, who is also Black. So as time goes by, Edie loses her job. She starts working for, you know, one of these services where she has to go do errands for people. I can't remember. It's not like Instacart, but they call it something in the book. And she comes in contact with Rebecca through this. And somehow she ends up going home with Rebecca and moving in with them. And our review said something like, there's no straightforward factual reason why this happened, you know, like a lot of things in life. It feels a little bit motiveless, or there are a million motives and you're not really sure why anybody's doing what they're doing, but Edie moves in with them and, you know, she realizes that part of it is that they want her to be friends with Akilah, who doesn't have any other Black people around to be friends with. And Leilani, her writing is just so sharp and funny. There was this one line where she overheard Akilah in a session with a tutor who they had hired to help her with something. And Edie didn't like the way the tutor was talking to her. And she was trying to tell Rebecca that she thought the tutor was being kind of racist and using microaggressions against Akilah. And Rebecca didn't really believe it. So Edie was kind of thinking, you know, all right, so I'm not being the right kind of Black friend that they want for her. And then there's just this line where Edie thinks, I creep around the house and try to be racially neutral. And I don't know why, that just made me laugh. She's so pointed. the other thing is that in addition to this whole interpersonal relation part, the whole beginning of the book is a lot about her job. And I find, I love books that take place in offices, and there just aren't that many of them. And, you know, so not only is this in an office, and there's all kinds of office politics and office friendships and Edie doing inappropriate things in the office, but there's a lot of stuff about publishing specifically and the issue of race, which obviously has been coming up a lot lately. And a lot of publishers, which are extremely white, are talking about ways that they can do better. So this is just one paragraph that I'm going to read a little bit of about her in her office. In the lobby, there is a diversity giveaway. I go up to the table and scan the books, and there are a few new ones. A slave narrative about a mixed-race house girl fighting for a piece of her father's estate. A slave narrative about a runaway's friendship with a white schoolteacher who selflessly teaches her how to read. A slave narrative about a tragic mulatto who raises the dead with her magic chitlin pies. A domestic drama about a black maid who, like Schrodinger's cat, is both alive and dead. An unseen nurturing presence who exists only within the bounds of her employer's four walls. An urban romance where everybody dies by gang violence, and a book about a Cantonese restaurant, which may or may not have been written by a white woman from Utah, whose descriptions of her characters rely primarily on rice-based foods. So that's her insight into the publishing industry and their diversity. So this book is just smart and sharp and funny in all different ways, and I would highly recommend that you read it.
And Laurie, I just loved the interview with the author that you did. The book just sounds so original and just highly appealing. And one thing that intrigued me was that Leilani mentioned that one of her favorite poets is Morgan Parker. Mm-hmm. And last year, Morgan Parker published her YA debut. It came out September 2019, called Who Put This Song On? And it's about a black teenage girl who's into like emo music and so on. And she's living in Southern California in this mostly white community where you're supposed to be like the opposite of emo, like, you know, perky and this and that. And she's, you know, she's dealing with anxiety and depression, but it's also a really funny book. And it's got a lot of really sharp observations about being marginalized and about being black in a, you know, mostly white setting. So I thought those could be interesting to read together since, Leilani admires Parker. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That sounds great. I didn't know that she had written fiction.
Cool. Laurie's pick for the week is Luster by Raven Leilani. Thank you, Laurie, for that pick. Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. Please tune in next week when my guest will be Jordan Ifueko, author of a really exciting, epic debut YA fantasy entitled Raybearer. So we'll be speaking with her then. But until that time, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.